This is The Lack with Nina Power and Benjamin Studebaker. Today we're discussing the film Strozik, and I will kick us off. Strozik came out in 1977. It was directed by Werner Herzog. Now I must warn you, Herzog wrote this film, and the dialogue has his cadence. It is impossible to read or listen to the dialogue without imagining it in his voice. It is a voice to which I am irresistibly drawn. I will do my level best not to indulge in frivolous impressions of Werner Herzog. I have tried my very hardest not to write this introductory piece in a style that would encourage me to adopt his cadence, and yet it seems overwhelmingly likely that I will, at some point in this episode, succumb to the desire. The film follows the title character, a West German man who is released from prison after a 2-year sentence. As he's released, the prison warden gives him a stern warning. All of Strozik's offenses come back to alcohol. He's got to stop drinking. He mustn't go back to the pub. The warden doesn't want to see Strozik again. Being a warden is depressing. Granting a man freedom is one of the few happy moments in his otherwise unhappy job. If Strozik drinks again, if he is arrested again and returned to the prison, he will take the warden's job away. Of course, Strozik immediately goes to the pub. It is a fateful mistake, for at the pub he encounters a battered woman, a prostitute named Eva. Foolishly, Strozik offers to help the woman by inviting her to live with him. He is not just motivated by naive kindness here. He wants her for himself, and somehow imagines her pimps will let him have her. No, of course not. Once Eva moves in with Strozik, the pimps begin a campaign of terror against the couple, repeatedly beating Eva and repeatedly humiliating Strozik. Strozik cannot do anything about this. We are told by his doctor that the fight was taken out of him in prison, that he doesn't know how to defend himself. Strozik has been in and out of institutions continuously. If he is arrested again, he will be committed to an asylum for alcoholics. But none of this makes an impression on him. He doesn't possess bourgeois reason and cannot enjoy bourgeois freedom without getting into trouble. It's only a matter of time before he's permanently committed. Or so we think. As it turns out, Eva has a different idea. What if they go to America? In America, she will be free of the pimps. They won't be brutally beaten all the time. She can get the money. She knows how to make money. They know an older man who has a relative in Wisconsin. She's heard everyone makes money in America. It's easy. Even at this stage, Strozik isn't so sure. He says he's too old, that he won't be able to adapt. She doesn't listen. Her objective is to escape the pimps, and she'll believe anything about America that helps her to do that. She's with Strozik because he offered her a place to go. If he wants to stay with her, he'll have to follow her to America. And because Strozik is desperate for the companionship of a woman who views men as mere means, he follows her into the land that will be his doom. Things are already bad at customs. The Americans confiscate Strozik's pet bird. Strozik made arrangements for the bird's care while he was in prison. He went to great lengths to keep this bird around, and just like that, it is taken from him. As cruel as those pimps were, they never hurt his bird. What kind of country confiscates a man's pet bird? Together, Eva and Strozik purchase a mobile home with a bank loan. Eva gets a job waiting tables, while Strozik works as a mechanic. They don't make enough money to keep up with the payments. A banker visits the house. He tells them that if they don't pay, the bank may repossess their home. The banker is very middle class. He doesn't threaten them with violence or attack them. He even makes a point of saying he would never want this outcome, that he is hopeful that they can find a way to make things work. But even though the banker goes about demanding money in a gentle way, the effect is the same. His visit forces Eva to return to prostitution. In a sense, the banker has himself become her pimp. In another deeper sense, there is no one individual who is her pimp, and yet she still has one, all the same. Capitalism, America, the country itself is Eva's pimp. But because this pimp doesn't beat Eva, she doesn't recognize the relationship of one as one of exploitation. She continues to profess her love of America as Strozik becomes ever more depressed and forlorn. Before long, his negativity about America is the most unpleasant part of Eva's life. Eva is only with Strozik to escape violence, which no longer threatens her. So when he becomes annoying, she abandons him. As she pulls away, her routine mirrors the banker's. It's not that she doesn't want to be around him. It's just that she's never had space to herself. He understands, doesn't he? No, Strozik does not understand. He does not understand English, a language he can't learn. He doesn't understand the true reason Eva is with him, and he doesn't understand the contract they have with the bank. What he does understand is that he doesn't understand. Strozik can tell he's being coerced, but because this coercion is indirect and comes from the market rather than the state, from the banker and from his own partner rather than from avowedly hostile pimps, it strikes him as insidious and frightening. He was much happier in Germany, where he was regularly imprisoned and attacked in his own home. After Eva leaves with a couple of truckers heading to Vancouver, Strozik gives up. He begins drinking heavily. The banker returns, telling him that the house will now be repossessed. Strozik doesn't understand, but signs the paperwork to make the banker go away. A short time later, the house is taken, auctioned off, and hauled away. Strozik's only remaining companion is the old man who brought them to Wisconsin. The old man feels terrible about what has happened. He becomes convinced that there must be some kind of conspiracy against them. He takes a rifle and tries to rob the bank, but finds that it's closed for the day. But everyone in town came to the auction to bid on the house. So the old man decides the entire community is part of the conspiracy and robs the next adjacent store. They steal a very small amount of petty cash and head across the street to a grocery store where they buy food. As the police sirens approach, they make no effort to get away. We are not even sure they know that the sirens are for them. Because the old man was the one holding the rifle, he is arrested for armed robbery. Strozik is overlooked. So he goes to the mechanic shop where he was working and steals a truck along with all the beer he can find. He drives and drives until the truck starts to give out and all the money he stole is gone. He finds himself in a small town in North Carolina. He tells his story to a local businessman who speaks German and can understand. The truck is overheating, but it still runs. Strozik starts the truck and hops out of the cab, leaving it circling the parking lot until it bursts into flames. He crosses the street and enters a roadside attraction. It contains various coin-operated animal exhibits. There is a dancing chicken, a rabbit fireman, a bird that plays the piano, and more. All of these exhibits have live animals. In Germany, Strozik himself had a piano, and there is a strong implication that he has something in common with these creatures. Like them, he has been socialized to behave in a limited way, in a way that is not fully human, yet gestures at the human. As Strozik boards a ski lift and takes his own life, Werner Herzog has us look at these animals in their cages. Their instincts have been manipulated by scientists to push them to behave like humans. But there is nothing truly human about them. This, it would seem, is Herzog's verdict on America. It apparently contains humans, but there is something inhuman about them. They appear to have been coached, to have been socialized to behave as if they understand what they do by force of habit and routine, by force of the market and the banks. Strozik was unable to handle German freedom, but he was too old to be trained to perform as an American. In Germany, his inability to handle freedom would result in incarceration. In America, he simply ends up dead in the mountains. This is perhaps Herzog's most political film. Usually, when we think of Herzog, we think of men in the jungle or in wild nature. But in this film, Herzog draws a sharp contrast between a Germany in which the state is actively trying to help you succeed and an America where the state takes no interest in your fate and leaves it completely in the hands of the market. For Herzog, the German state incarcerates you for your own good. German society is violent and uncertain, but this is what makes German society free. In America, everyone is armed, and that makes society unfree because it generates a mutual fear that makes people unsociable. And the state? It only shows up after shots have been fired, when it's too late to make a positive intervention. You might think the man who makes the nature documentaries would be a libertarian, but that's really not it. Herzog is a Weberian statist who thinks the state must prepare the citizen for freedom. When the state fails to prepare the citizen must protect society from the citizen and the citizen from himself. When the state steps back and allows market forces to produce and structure society, this is an abrogation of its responsibility. On his telling, states and markets both condition society far more than society conditions either. And given a choice between the state and the market, Herzog seems to prefer the state, although he also seems to admit that a woman might prefer the market. Fascinating. Let's see if Nina read this film the same way.
Oh my goodness. Well, yes, I was curious to know how you'd understand this film. I mean, not least because you are in America and American by birth and training, perhaps, in many ways. And of course, yeah, I wondered how you'd read Eva, given our discussion last week about the Egyptian film and the main female protagonist in that film, who you judge much more harshly than I did. And once again, you have judged the female protagonist much more harshly than I would. And I think this is an interesting point of ongoing, not tension, but, you know, a friendly disagreement between us because of questions of opportunity, agency, and so on. I happen to think that Eva is also a very, very delightful character in and of herself in this film. I think she's very charming. And the woman who plays her is in Fassbinder films as well, which can't help but endear her to me. And there's a lot of overlap in some ways between Herzog and Fassbinder, at least in this film, I think. I mean, many things. I wanted to return to Herzog because I think Herzog is one of these directors. Obviously, he's still alive. He's still making films. He's had an enormously varied career, although he does have some kind of ongoing fundamental concerns, many of which we could perhaps characterize as a commitment to a certain kind of German romanticism, a certain kind of tragic pathos, sometimes a kind of humorous post-humanism in the sense of he often talks about, or he has talked about, what the planet would be like without us. And there is a kind of deep romanticism of nature, although here it's presented in a slightly more depressing and mechanical light, perhaps. But he's, you know, very, he says some very funny things. He's a deeply eccentric man who is also interested in eccentric people, for example, people who are obsessed with bears in Grizzly Man. And Bruno, the character here, is played by, who's also in the Kaspar Hauser film, I think, who's played by a man who has this almost parallel life to the character in this film. So somebody who's brought up in care, who's a kind of self-taught, autodidact musician, somebody who lives somewhat on the edges, who has had an explicit relation to the state, as you point out. And I agree, it's very interesting to think of the state in this paternalistic light, you know, the idea that a prison warden, the boss would come and speak to somebody like that and try to give them life advice at the beginning of the film is very it's very moving, actually, in a way, like somebody trying to not just be bureaucratic, but to think of prisons in this older way as almost something like reform, places of reform, which at one point people thought they might be, especially for women, actually. Women's prisons were often about retraining women to be good women, right? So they would be taught all kinds of womanly skills, like sewing and so on, in order to sort of slot them back. But really, contemporary incarceration has none of these aspirations to reform or any kind of idea that the state has a sort of obligation to its population, not just the people who are being protected, but the people who are also in protection. I was thinking about Herzog lately, almost in terms of his legacy, actually, and wondering what I would make of Herzog now, right? He's somebody I think that people often in their 20s really like, because he sort of presents an image of the world as kind of magical, slightly strange and kooky and bizarre. And, you know, he's very influential on directors like Harmony Korine. I think he appears in Gummo or one of Harmony Korine's films as a kind of patriarchal or stepfather. He has this amazing accent. My favourite Herzog film is actually, I mean, apart from the ones with Klaus Kinski, which are just extraordinary, and I think Kinski is probably one of the greatest 20th century actors, a terrible human being, but, you know, we try not to make these kinds of judgments. But is a short documentary he made about a volcano called La Sufria, which I don't know if you've seen, where he tries to go to a volcano explosion, but it's all about the island and the people who stay. And he finds all of these people who are staying on the island despite the possible immediate eruption to imminently arrive. And he asks them about their philosophy of life and why they're staying on the island, given that it'll likely kill them. And it's extremely beautiful and a very, very moving reflection. And it hits scenes of desolation when everyone else has fled the island and so on. But this film, yeah, I wonder if how much we might kind of put the blame, rest the blame at Herzog's feet for a certain fetishization of the unusual, which carried on, I think, in publications like Vice, which have recently kind of folded. And I'm not necessarily saying there's anything wrong with this. I think a world in which we are interested in the eccentric or pay attention to differences. And one thing I was thinking rewatching this film was, oh my gosh, imagine how if one was moving to another country and it was genuinely different in kind, you know, and you didn't really have any understanding of what it would be like, you know, you didn't have any access to media, or maybe you'd seen a few images, you had some, you know, fantasy like Eva does about California, or, you know, the idea that you can make money in America, that's what America's about. And that was it. Like, imagine you just transported yourself entirely in this kind of state of ignorance. And that's no longer possible, even since the 70s in many ways, right? Especially, clearly, these are people who are kind of marginalized, who just about get enough money through Eva's hard work to leave, and indeed she's the only person who really provides any money at all in this entire film. And she actually seems like a very good waitress, I have to say. She fits into the American system quite well. She's friendly, she pours coffee for everyone, she learns how to speak English. You know, she could be a good waitress if she didn't have to make money for these other men who have massively overreached in terms of their aspirations. but in any case, so I think there's something kind of very, very moving about these eccentric people who find each other and move across somewhere in a, you know, completely strange and baroque landscape. Originally, this film was supposed to be about Ed Gein, I think, the murderer. Like, was it Ed Gein? I can't remember. Anyway, Herzog wanted to make a film about American serial killers, and he ended up making this film instead. so I think maybe it was is a better film than one about Ed Gein or something like this. But clearly, I agree that his sort of perception or his vision of America is very brutal. It is an idea of human nature that has been, as you say, completely agree with you on the differential political system, the idea you want to make. I think the key dialogue is obviously the one in which Bruno talks about the fact that in Germany the violence was direct and immediate and personal, and in America it is indirect. It comes with a smile and a suit. And he says, yeah, like that he prefers, even though it's probably more horrible in some ways, he prefers the direct violence to the indirect violence, because economic violence and coercion and the kind of indifference to those who do not have money and those who are marginalized or on the margins of society is harder to live with, right? It's the idea that you really are without, as you said, without care. Nobody cares. Nobody cares what you do. And once again, I would like to give an optimistic read on the scene with the gun. We don't know for sure if he kills himself. We hear a shot, but after all, there are some llamas at the top of the... maybe he shot a llama. We don't know. We just don't know. It's left completely. Benjamin is looking extremely skeptically at me. But just like in the other film, the horrible, violent Cormac McCarthy film, I don't think he killed her. I don't think he necessarily kills himself. It's obviously not shown. So it's obvious that he leaves it open, right? That this gesture is, you know, obscured. And that's good. Yeah, and I think these acts of kind of absurdism and nihilism that involve guns, just like the farmers who are stalking a piece of land, barely constrained violence between them, is indeed symptomatic of a kind image of individual freedom that has become extremely unfree. And in that sense, I do agree with you. I am perhaps more sceptical of Herzog these days because... I wonder, I don't know how to put it. I really admire Herzog. Let's be clear. I think he's made some of the most extraordinary films, and especially the ones with Kinski and this documentary. But I don't know if his image of the world, his vision of the world is sufficient. I think it leads to a kind of fetishization of the eccentric and the absurd for its own sake, which can in turn be exploitative of that idea of the world. You know, there's a kind of hipster middle-class fetishization that we saw in publications like Vice for lives led in very different ways. And it's a very fine line to tread, I think. I think that Herzog is sympathetic here. He said that of Bruno S. that he was the best actor he ever worked with, and he worked with Kinski and others. So this is kind of a massive thing for Herzog to say. You know, he was enormously complimentary towards this man who he described as a kind of natural actor, you know, that just is someone who is just this force of life. And we know that this is, I guess, a very British thing, but we know that Ian Curtis, the singer from Joy Division, watched Strosek the night before he committed suicide. And this has always been attached to the film somehow, as if this is indicative, possibly because Ian Curtis was about to tour America and was having marital problems or relationship problems. And so people often try to map the plot of Strosek onto Ian Curtis's own life, as if to give a explanation as to why Curtis took his own life. I don't like reductive explanations for suicide, but it's if you're British, you will have heard this fact many times. So yeah,
interesting. Well, I want to make the point. I think that this is Herzog's view of the female character. I'm not necessarily endorsing it, but I do think that this is the film's position on the character. I think that the film itself is views her as having kind of pushed him into this when he, even from the very beginning, did not really want to go. And she, he says there isn't enough money to do this. I don't have enough money. How would we come up with money? And she says, don't worry about money. She'll find a way. So it's not as if these men are overreaching and saying, oh, we can do this, and then failing her. She's the one pushing them, in the case of Strosek, out of the comfort zone. The pimps are a different matter entirely from him, of course. But Strosek is dragged into this by her assuring him repeatedly that she's going to make it work financially. And so when she abandons a man who doesn't speak the language, doesn't have the means to support himself, has said openly and admitted honestly that he doesn't think he can support himself in America or find his way in America alone. She abandons him. And I think you would be very critical of that if the sexes were reversed, but you're inclined to be more forgiving because it's a woman.
No, I refute this. I I think, you know, look, it's Strosek who approaches Eva in the bar, right? She's in the bar. He decides that he wants Eva, right?
But his situation in the bar is not it's not a financial issue. It's not that he's made a financial commitment he can't back up. She knows full well that when she goes over there, that that's just a temporary relief from those pimps. The only way to get permanent relief from the pimps would be to go further away from them. She knows that.
Right. But I mean, what's wrong with wanting to get away from these people and start a new life?
Well, because she knows she can't really get away from them by moving in with him. What she can do is bring the violence and carnage into his house, which is what happens. And they destroy some of his instruments. They wreck up his place. She brings all of this into his space.
I really don't think it's her fault. I mean, these men have agency too. They're the ones who decide to do that, right?
Oh, I say that I think he's a total fool for inviting her, right? But of course, also she knows that this guy is not a guy who has his life together. She's well acquainted with him and his past and his history. And she knows that he's not someone who's really capable of being an adult.
But why is she? I mean, she's in a terrible situation. If she's working in the first place as a prostitute in some dumpy part of the city, like...
Oh, she is in a terrible situation. But this is the point I want to make about prostitution here, is that prostitution involves taking an instrumental attitude to all the men around you. If you're a prostitute, you have to approach all of these relationships as transactional and commercial. So her whole life, every relationship is always already marketized. So what I'm really trying to critique here is not her as an individual. I'm trying to critique the market and the role the market plays in shaping her life and her outlook and the way that she interacts with people, right? So because she always already was in an entirely marketized relationship with every man she ever met, when she comes to America, it's very easy for her to adapt. She's already prepared for that way of relating to the world.
I don't disagree, but I think it's not clear, for example, whether she has a sexual relationship with Strosek. It's not clear, I think.
Well, she was sleeping in the same room, in the same bed with him for a while, and then she announces she's not going to do that anymore. And then he's upset about that. So she was giving him some kind of intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
That she then withdraws.
Sure, but I don't think her affection for him can be reduced to purely mercenary exchange, image of exchange.
I don't think she's capable of loving a man in a conventional sense. I think that capacity in her has been destroyed by marketization.
I think there are other kinds of affection you can have, even if that's true. And I think there are moments where she's genuinely happy and at ease and playful and fun, with, for example, with the bird and when she first arrives to America. And, you know, clearly she's not faithful in any sense. She's not faithful to the project. In the end, she just leaves, possibly because Strosek has become so boring and depressing that this seems to be her only option.
Well, where I would put the critique is Herzog in suggesting that Germany is this state, West Germany is this state dominated society, mm-hmm. and America is this market dominated society, mm-hmm. doesn't grasp that the prostitute was already conditioned principally by the market and by money, even though she was brought up in Germany. There was already a failure on the part of the German state to deal with women, right? The German state, while it tries to create the free man, was insufficiently interested in the fate of women on this telling. And so women are completely pushed to the margins of it. So I think there is a kind of, the feminist reading of the film would be that the German state, while it's interested in male freedom, fails to take an interest in female freedom, pushes women into this kind of marketized position, which then makes them amenable to a completely kind of soulless Americanization, which the men are inclined to resist.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with that. I mean, Germany has had a long tradition of female prostitution at scale. I don't know why, particularly It's something we massively associate with Weimar. I have various books about this. It was really out of hand. It was, and yeah. Now
I'd be expecting you to critique that. Usually that's something that bothers you.
I'm not in favor of prostitution. I think it's a terrible mode of being.
Right, and it has negative effects on how you relate to the world and other people. You know, and yeah. It's not just that it involves the exploitation of the woman, which of course it does. It involves the exploitation of the woman. She's been conditioned to accept this exploitation and to view it as normal, right? But on top of that, it also negatively affects how she relates to the rest of the world, because something that's supposed to be about love and intimacy has been commercialized for her.
Sure. But again, it's not clear what choices she really has in this situation, you know.
But that's a failure of the German state. So there's an angle here for criticizing the German state.
Yeah.
I think that's where, if you want to kind of flip the initial logic of the film, is to view it from the perspective of the guy and to think about what the guy says in terms of how he'd rather have the state than this market society.
Sure.
But she never got that state.
Yeah.
You know, and she doesn't even feel like she can call the police when she's being beaten.
Yeah.
So she doesn't even feel like she can appeal to the German state. She feels like she's a nothing to it.
Yeah, indeed.
So I'm not judging her in this. I'm trying to talk about the ways she's conditioned.
Yeah, for sure. And in a sense, her options seem to be violent men or a strange man, you know. And of course, in that situation, like, the promise of a country that you don't know much about would seem like ideal, right? Or it would be a genuine promise, right?
Right. But what's really horrible about it is that she's already been prepared by the way in which the German state has marginalized her to just go along with and accept this very ideological relation.
Yeah, I don't know how to put this. Like, all of these are forms of male domination. They're just direct or indirect, right? So it's not like women come up with any of these things, particularly. And as many in the second wave pointed out, like, the sexual revolution simply meant that women went from being private property to public property, you know, and prostitution became a kind of generalized expectation under the guise of free love, right? And in that sense, yeah, I find my sympathy very much lying with Eva, in the sense that, you know, her choices, she actually makes some bold decisions and expresses her freedom, as limited as it is, in these different situations. And yeah, she is adaptable, but I think that's because women are adaptable in certain ways, because they have to be. And I think that, yeah, we don't get enough of her backstory to understand anything. She's simply, like, at the bar, and that's it.
Well, I don't think it's really about which of these characters do you sympathize with. It's a question of which of these forms of state or forms of society, which of these social systems, if either, do you sympathize with? Do you buy the way in which Herzog contrasts Germany and the United States? Are those depictions accurate? And then, insofar as we take that, where do we sit? So I'm thinking about it more in terms of systems.
No, I know, but, like, systems are made of people. And this is a very, very humane film. It's about, and this is actually why maybe I'm coming around to defending Herzog, because his obsession with eccentricity and strangeness and unusual characters like Caspar Hauser and all of these people who are, like, basically on the margins or outcasts or just have the most unusual backstories or do the strangest things are about, I think, this kernel of humanness and personality, which are not reducible to systems. And I think Eva also manifests this. And Herzog was going out with her, for goodness sake, as many directors do with their leading women. But I think it's also about capturing that idiosyncrasy, right, of character and personality. And yes, of course, systems. Yes, of course, training. But it can't just be that, right? And I don't think Herzog is saying we're all just a bit like trained chickens, or that even people in America are just like trained chickens.
I think especially people in America are just like trained chickens.
But I think that's a horribly nihilistic part of it. And I think he's maybe, if he's saying that at all, he's saying it in a humorous way, not in a, oh, this is, we're all just doomed and condemned and manipulated and like dancing chickens.
Well, earlier you said, and I think that you have a point here, that there is a little bit of a post-humanist tinge to Herzog.
Yes.
And I think that's in part why Herzog very rarely makes films that are about society or about politics. Mm-hmm. He'll make films about enigmatic people, but yeah. often enigmatic people who are connected to wild nature, who yeah. go outside of society or outside of politics. And this is a rare instance in which he actually tackles the political and the social head on. And I think if he had the kind of view you're suggesting that he has, he would make this kind of film more often than he does. I think this kind of film is a difficult one to make for him because he doesn't really have something positive to say about human society. I think he himself has said on a number of occasions he's not like the people that he chooses to film.
No.
Some people think that Herzog himself must be mad or must also be yeah. this kind of person. But he says, no, he's not at all like that. Actually, he's very normal and very sane and very bourgeois. And so there is a kind of freak show aspect to his
right.
work.
Right. That's what I was trying to point to.
Yes. At the same time, though, I do think you're right that there is a sort of end of history nostalgia for people who are more fully human than he feels he himself is. And
yeah.
that's the sense in which we get a sense that he respects and empathizes with his freaks. And so we see this oscillation in his work between the freak show side, which is comedic and making fun of the people, and this empathetic desire for the fully human person, which I think comes from that German ideal of freedom, complete the cycle of German idealism. Mm-hmm. There is a little bit of that still in Herzog, or a nostalgia for that, or a wish that he could believe in that.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't actually believe in it. He's not a German modern, but he's someone who is shaped by having been born into a world where German modernism was still a thing that people believed.
Yes. Yes, I agree with that. And I think his romanticism is sort of very knowing in that sense, right? Because precisely he is this character who accepts the world in a certain sense, though maybe tragically. And yeah. But what about my point about the kind of hipster take up of the sort of Herzogian laugh of weirdos and eccentric? Because, like, can I just say, you know, as a Gen X person, this was a huge dimension of the culture, like everything from, what was it called, the Jim Rose circus, like freak shows, like Vice, like Channel 4 in the UK. Like, there was the culture at a certain point was really extremely interested in fringe cases, marginal people, you know, people who did weird things. It was completely obsessed with this, actually, often to a point of cruelty. Sometimes it was sympathetic. A lot of the time it was not. There was a lot of kind of poverty porn. And this idea of like, especially around, I don't know, people living in Russia or parts of, I don't know, like how to describe it. But Vice at a certain period was very, very emblematic of this desire, like this.
And Herzog himself made a film about Russian fur trappers.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So there is a sense and like ethnography is fascinating, right? The history of documentary film is completely tied up with ethnography, for better or worse, right? Because a lot of the first documentaries were made of weird people, like Eskimos and, you know, groups that had never previously been on camera, and you can completely understand the ethnographic and anthropological and curious desire to do this, right? So Nanuk of the North and all of these things, you know, they basically get this like Eskimo to eat a vinyl record because they like pretend he's never seen one before. And, you know, like there's something kind of terrible about this too, obviously, right? And a lot of the time, you know, it's like those Disney movies where they like push lemmings off cliffs because everybody knows that lemmings jump off cliffs when the population gets too high, but they weren't doing it. So they just threw them off cliffs, you know what I mean? It's like you want your subject to do the thing that you associate with your subject, correctly or otherwise. And I think we had this kind of neo-ethnography going on all the time, like very, very heavily in the culture. And that stopped, you know, and if you want to say like, okay, maybe some of the political correctness was a backlash against that, right? It was like, what the hell? This is a bit Roman Empire. We're all obsessed with like pointing and laughing and like watching people who have less education and are poorer do things that we find like stunning and marvelous and strange. And by watching this, we will somehow enchant our own life and think about how weird it is to be alive and to be human, right? And so I'm very...
Here comes Honey Boo Boo.
Oh, right. Okay. I vaguely remember. Was this about like an overweight girl or something?
Yes. Yes. That this was, I think, the kind of extreme example of this that started to really cause people to want to draw a line under it was this exploitation of a young girl who was being overfed and fed bad food by her mother, camera crew following the bad parenting of this girl. And of course, nothing being done. And if anything, the bad parenting being encouraged because of its telegenic quality. I agree with you. There's whenever we judge a work, right? There's what the person intended. There's what they did or the readings that the text itself gives, right? And then there is the impact and influence that the person's work has had. And here you're drawing attention to Herzog's influence and impact. And I think in particular, there's an Anglophone take-up of Herzog that is flawed because it doesn't have the human aspect that is in Herzog's work because of this influence of German idealism on the way that Herzog is in the world. And that's missing when the Anglophone fans of Herzog take it up. They don't have this notion of the free person that comes from this kind of Hegelian tradition.
Right.
And so they don't play with it in the dialectical way in which Herzog plays with it. So it comes across as much more exploitative. And then when you see that this is the influence of Herzog, then when you look back at Herzog's films, you see this exploitative side, the one-sided Anglo interpretation of it in his films themselves.
Sure.
But I don't think that was what he intended. And I think that when people originally saw these films, what they got out of it was not just that. It's just that when an Anglophone person tries to produce that effect, there tends to be a misrecognition or misapprehension of what really goes on in a Herzog film that results in this crass, one-sided caricature.
Yeah, sure. And yeah, to be fair, I'm not accusing Herzog of doing that. I don't think you know, and I also don't blame him necessarily. You know, of course, we're not responsible for those people we influence. It's like we used to joke about this at Warwick, like, you know, how can Deleuze be responsible for Deleuzians? Because Deleuzians were often like insanely dogmatic, at least we thought so. And, you know, do you know what I mean? It's like we don't blame.
Yeah. Well, it does say something about the unsuitability of the ideas for the future or for the society in which they are received, right? There's something unsuitable about Herzog's ideas for his audience because his audience does not have the connection to the tradition that he has. They can't receive it in the spirit in which it's given to them.
Yeah, okay, but then let's just push a bit harder on this. I mean, the spirit in which it's given is a very tragic, melancholic one, actually. You know, it is very end of history. He's not presenting a positive worldview. It's certainly not a religious worldview. I'm not saying he has to. He doesn't, you know, there's something very Schopenhauerian about Herzog. You know, he is very charming and enigmatic and has this beautiful voice himself, even if he is bourgeois and all of these things. And of course he is, because he has to get funding to make his damn films. And he, you know, he gets to make his films, right? So of course he has to be like an organized, sorted, sensible person who doesn't just like burn piles of money or run away or whatever, you know? So like, of course, but I wonder, and I think as a counterweight, let's say, against this kind of, you know, push to be positive or even some of the ecological green movement, I often think of Herzog as opposed to them in a way, you know, because it's like his image of nature is this violent and cruel and you know, it's not this cute nature which we somehow have to look after and feel guilty about, right? Like he doesn't have this image of nature at all. Like it's very violent and messy. And I take Herzog's image of nature far more. Like I agree with him. I think he's right. It's brutal. You know, we only pretend to harness it. We only pretend to control it. We only pretend to be able to deal with natural disasters. You know, it's only temporary. So I think it's like, you know, he's brilliant at diagnosing and looking back and this melancholy and nostalgia for the character or the person, you know, the stranger, the weirdo. But yeah, Yeah, it is Hegelian. I mean, it's like the Isle of Minerva. It's like the filmmaker of Minerva, looking back in some ways.
Yeah, yeah. In some ways, I also, it's a very different kind of thing, but I think it's similar. The Wes Anderson Twee thing is very aesthetically different, but yeah. Similar in that it expresses a nostalgia for a kind of person that can't exist anymore and which the filmmaker themselves can't really believe in. But I think with Herzog, this is more intellectually developed.
Yeah. You
know, this is a kind of person that on some level Herzog wishes he could be or wishes could come back, but also which he regards as mad and which he regards as unsuitable for our present times and circumstances.
But is it the authentic?
And I think that...
Is that what it is? You know, because Bruno is authentic, right? This is what you must say of this person.
I think it's not just that he's authentic. It's there a sense that he cannot be conditioned, mm-hmm. in at least not to the same degree as everybody else, that the conditioning just doesn't take with him.
Okay.
And so it shows a kind of incompleteness and a possibility of this other kind of person that used to exist somehow still coming into being.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this kind of tension with, is he unsuited for freedom or is he the most free person because he can't be conditioned? There's a little bit of a back and forth, I think, about that. And you could take Herzog here to be a statist who says in a kind of Weberian way, and I think this is a tension within the tradition of German idealism itself, that the state has to play this directive role because if it doesn't play this directive role, you won't really get free bourgeois subjects. They will not just be organically produced by the market. If you let the market produce people, there will be this immaturity and unsuitableness that you will have to reckon with at some later point.
I mean,
and on the other hand, yeah. a different kind of aspect where you have from the same tradition, this idea that the state should not be producing people, that that's a kind of culture comp, that there's a pure bourgeois subject that can nonetheless emerge from society itself without the need for state intervention. Something that has never really worked at scale, but which I think a lot of kind of fans of the 19th century German tradition are still romantically committed to, including many contemporary Marxists, romantically committed to this idea that market society can nonetheless produce a bourgeois subject capable of engaging in free activity or in bringing about a world where free activity is possible.
I think it's manifestly clear that the market does not do that. The market creates people who are prone to all kinds of unfreedoms, actually, masquerading as freedoms, whether it be debt or addiction or whatever. Because it's not... Well, it's not sufficient, apart from anything else, right? Like, it doesn't have a model of the human being at its center, which is in any way organic or robust. Right. If you treat everybody as a calculating machine or, you know, you have no conception of our relationality, our sociability or whatever else. Right.
Yeah, there's this Kantian conception of the person as having the two moral powers, you know, the Rawlsian two moral powers, and you just give them the primary goods, you water them a little bit with some very, very basic things, and these qualities will flourish and they'll become free and capable. And that's something that I think that is the big lie of modern liberalism. It's the big thing that doesn't happen. And there's lots of different ways of thinking about why that doesn't happen. And you can get left wing and you can get right wing about it in various ways.
Yeah.
But I think that there's right now there's a big desire to not engage with the legacy of the 20th century. The legacy of the 20th century is the legacy of that theory not working, it having extremely negative consequences, the attempt to go about making social change through that kind of theory. And a need to reckon with that and in some way improve the theory.
I don't disagree. And it is very interesting how many people, as you say, from across the political spectrum have come to similar conclusions from very different starting points as regard liberalism. And, you know, I'm very struck by Patrick Deneen, post-liberal, I guess you would say, his claim when he says that, you know, liberalism failed because it succeeded. Which I think is quite clever, right? In the sense that, like, by pushing this image of the market and the free individual and so on to such an extreme at the cost of all other social values, or indeed value itself beyond the market, it is both kind of fulfilled itself in doing so has kind of destroyed itself because it's destroyed the material of its politics, right?
It's destroyed the capacities of the citizens to form the kinds of associations that the theory presupposes must, of course, exist and will, of course, exist.
Right, exactly. And and the idea that we can simply apply this political system indifferently to everybody, regardless of their starting points or their abilities or needs or wants or wishes, and basically tell everyone to make their own way and to develop their own moral system, like at scale, all 9 billion people, is insane. I mean, this is just a very, very unworkable...
On the assumption that they will converge on enough stuff that it will be fine.
Right, exactly.
Because reason will cause them to converge on enough stuff.
Right, and that pluralism will always be, if not harmonious...
Manageable.
Yeah, it will be... not antagonistic enough, that everyone will be more or less indifferent enough to everybody else's divergent views and ways of life, that somehow this will function in some uneasy way. I mean, pluralism in a sense is our reality. I mean, I live in London, which is now incredibly pluralistic. It was at the end of Ramadan today, and London was extremely Muslim, I have to say. I think it was today, there are very, very many Muslims around today, and it gives you a very different image of the city than one that would have existed even 100 years ago. And I'm saying that in a neutral way. I am not necessarily saying it's negative, but it's a very massive change in the composition, the demographic and religious composition, cultural composition of the city and of the country.
I would say that it produces some political problems in the UK insofar as it creates an estrangement between London and the cultural politics of London, which are necessarily about multiculturalism and about managing this diversity, and the cultural politics of the rest of the country, which isn't going to be that way because it isn't demographically that way.
Well, you
and
say
I think
that.
That's been going on in a lot of European states, where you get this concentration of immigrants in the metropole because European countries do a very bad job of spreading immigrants throughout the country in a way that prevents them from clustering in just one spot. And then that produces regional antagonisms.
I don't know. I think in Britain it's more complicated because there are very many other parts of the country that are very Muslim heavy. For example, Bradford, parts of Birmingham, lots of the Northwest. This obviously,
but always in the cities.
Yeah, some small towns. I mean, you have like smaller places as well. Even where my parents live in Wiltshire is now becoming extremely multicultural compared to when I grew up.
Well, like if you look at the demographics, right, in London, demographically, it looks like the United States in terms of the percentages of people, right? And then if you look at the UK as a whole, it doesn't look anything like the United States. All minority groups in the UK as a whole are smaller than just the African-American population in the United States as a percentage of the total. So there's still a quite sharp difference in the UK as a whole versus the London region. And I think that's something that gets obviated because of how much British media is London-based. And I think that's a big part of why people who don't live in London are afraid of the immigrants, because they don't really interact with them very much, but they hear about them all the time because they don't live in places where it's very common or where there's a whole lot of interaction. The people who interact with immigrants tend to be less bothered about them than the people who don't.
Yes and no, I would say. It depends on what you're doing and which part of the city you live in, whether you live in a rich part or a poor part.
Well, just put it this way. It's not like London is a region that voted heavily for Brexit. It's not like London is a region where you have Brexit Party, or what's it called now? They're always changing the name. Reform Party candidates polling well.
Yeah.
Was UKIP, then the Brexit Party, then the Reform Party. Those are all the same thing, I think, broadly speaking. A lot of the same people involved. But those organizations don't poll well in the places where you actually have concentrations. And not just because the immigrants don't support those parties. It's also because if you were to talk to the professionals who live in the metropoles, they tend to be more pro-immigration and more pro-mobility and more cosmopolitan.
Yeah, I mean, I think that might be changing at this point. I think if you look at Matt Goodwin's polling work, I think there is... been a kind of slight turn against immigration because it doesn't seem to be providing these great economic since Brexit. I mean, because we kind of shifted from European immigration to global immigration, and this brought in
part of the story, right, is that London is economically nothing like the rest of the UK either. Most of the people who live in central London come from affluent backgrounds, or they're immigrants. And the working class population that would have been in London historically has been pushed further and further outside by higher housing costs.
Yeah, but I mean, every time the British public have ever had the opportunity to vote on immigration, they've always voted for less. It's just that no government has ever actually done what they said they were going to.
Well, the British population, what about the London population?
Sure, but I wonder if that isn't changing too, honestly.
That would be remarkable because, you know, one thing that's a kind of iron law of politics in the last 30 years is that cities vote for center-left parties. And sure. The more densely populated the city is, the more likely it is to vote for the center left.
Yeah, but I think we're having all kinds of flips. I mean, you also get lots of people who are like first and second generation immigrants voting against immigration, right? I mean, this happens. You have lots of strangers.
Yes, though generally those people have become suburban, or they've become small business owners, or they've economically and geographically changed positions in the society. I don't think that any of this is racial, right? No, I don't think any of this is tied to religion. It's tied to the kind of place where you live. If you live in a cosmopolitan city where you rub shoulders with everybody all the time, the diversity becomes very normal and very routinized, right? And you see, because you just are living in the city all the time, that it's not exceptionally dangerous or way more dangerous than it used to be. The crime rates in these cities have not gone through the roof or anything like that. But then if you live out in the suburbs, you live further out, maybe you've got a small business that's geographically fixed and relies on the strength of the local economy, the fact that local people's wages aren't going up is a problem for you.
Sure.
You know, I think small business owners don't benefit particularly from immigration. And then competition on wages means that the local population has less to spend locally. So it's not a great win for them generally.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we'll see. I do wonder slightly whether we will see more candidates proposing tough on law and order, tough on immigration, you know.
Oh, we will, but it'll be mainly because people who live out in the burbs hear about all the crimes that occur in the cities, but don't live in them and don't experience them on a day-to-day basis. So there's this huge mismatch between what people hear and what actually goes on. Statistically, the crime rates in the cities have all gone down in recent years.
Sure, although I doubt that it's felt like that. I mean, there have been an awful lot of extremely violent incidents around where I live recently. And it's one of those things where it's not really like, okay, you can look at the stats, right? And you can have a purely rational, neutral understanding of them. And then you can also live in a place that's getting increasingly violent. Like I walk around a lot and I've seen three police incident, violent incidents, or the aftermath thereof in the past 5 days.
Yeah, but there's so many people who live near you. The percentage of people over the course of a year who are still involved in these violent incidents is fairly low. But of course, you see it all the time because cities are dense. So geographically, a violent incident will always happen in proximity to you just because of how many people are around. And this is, I think, the thing about cities that is fundamentally misleading. There's so many people around that you're always going to hear about something terrible happening, even if terrible things happen a very, very small percentage of the time.
Sure.
Because of the sheer density of it. There's something intrinsically misleading about urban environments.
Well, perhaps, but you know, you see what you see.
Anyway, we're going to go do the B-side. Thank you guys so much for listening and have a wonderful rest of the day. Bye-bye.
Bye.